You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Today we have the pleasure of having Dr. Chandran Kukuthas here to talk to us about capitalism, human nature, and the meaning of life. Dr. Kukuthas is a professor of political science at Singapore Management University, as well as a distinguished affiliated fellow with the F.A. Hayek program here at Mercatus. He's a leading political theorist known for his work on liberalism, multiculturalism, and political thought of F.A. Hayek. Some of his books include The Liberal Archipelago, Immigration and Freedom, and his newest book, Dialogues on Immigration and the Open Society, that was released this year. We're a pleasure to have you here, and I'll turn it over to you, Chandran, as you talk.
Thanks, Stephanie, and thanks everyone for coming, and to those of you on Zoom as well. My title today is one that promises more than I'm going to deliver. This is something people might say about a lot of my talks, but anyway, usually the titles are a bit more modest. But let me give you a little bit of context. I'm engaged in a longer-term project on capitalism, trying to understand what it is, understand classical liberal arguments for it, understand socialist arguments against it. And I came to this really out of a certain dissatisfaction with a lot of debates and discussions of capitalism, because I think people don't really have a clear idea of what they mean by the term. And I think on the critic side, they tend to put into the term capitalism everything they don't like. And equally on the other side, those who are in favor tend to put into it everything that they do like, and to say that everything that is wrong with capitalism is due to interference with capitalism, as I hope to make clear. I don't think that's a plausible claim either. But the larger thing that I want to try to say something about is what lies behind the imperative to do something about capitalism, whether it's reforming it or abolishing it or preserving it. And I think it's got something to do with the idea that we can control things to an extent that we really can't. So I'm going to start from the beginning and recognize that we are a fairly insignificant dot somewhere in the universe. Said that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, but I'm going to assume otherwise, at least for the sake of argument, that we're just a little species on top of this floating rock shared with billions and squillions of other creatures hurtling around the solar system or around the sun, which is itself, you know, journeying around the Milky Way, which is itself in the end going to clash with Andromeda. So, you know, even if the second law of thermodynamics won't eventually get you, probably the galactic collision will. So, you know, we're just this tiny thing with great dreams of transformation. We're just occupying really a tiny bit of this top surface, but we have dreams of shaping the environment. We have dreams that are quite different from those of other creatures on the planet, but just more or less could tend to just keep on going, you know, just survive. But we have dreams, among other things, of terraformation, and we even have dreams of radical economic transformation. We have dreams that somehow we're going to transform capitalism and we're going to do it now. And all of this seems to me a little bit crazy, but this is the world that we live in. We live in a world of people with these sorts of dreams. Now, why is this the case? Because after all, if we look at the history of the 20th century, at least if we look at it from the perspective not of attempts at terraformation, but at the attempts of social transformation, it's been at best a mixed history. Some would say a history of more or less total failure, to the extent that we've actually tried to achieve something that was achievable. But why is this happening? Well, social systems, I want to suggest to you, are a reflection of our nature. We have the social systems that we do because of the kinds of creatures that we are. And part of our nature, I also want to say, is that we have these desires to transform things, to shape the world. Now, one of the questions is whether this feature of our nature is itself something that is fixed or alterable. And some of us think that this itself is alterable. This is a part of our condition. We have a nature that wants to transform the world, maybe wants to shape other parts of the solar system, maybe even further and further beyond this. But I'm not so sure that this is a great idea. But I want to say that there's something about this that we need to try to understand better if we're going to understand capitalism and our relationship with it. So what is it about our nature then that we should think about? Here's where I would start, not where I would end, but I think this is something that we should consider. Hobbes says in The Leviathan that he would put for a general inclination of all mankind a perpetual and restless desire for power after power that seetheth only in death. I guess what he means by this is that the desires that we have can never be satisfied. However much power we acquire, and I don't mean just power over other people or other things, but the power to shape the world or to get something further is innately unsatisfiable. This is what I think he's saying about our nature. Something in our nature that means that we're never going to be satisfied. We might be happy in some way, but this happiness will not be as the result of our having fulfilled our desire or reached our goals, but simply as a result of our maybe lowering our expectations, maybe just getting tired. And I think that's probably why I'm pretty happy. Actually, getting close to retirement and I can just chill out a little bit. But have I achieved my dreams? No. But I'm kind of getting to the point where I can put them on the back burner and, you know, not worry about them so much. Now, what does all of this have to do with capitalism? Okay, so this is what I'm trying to work towards. So to understand this, we have to say something about what capitalism is. Okay, so let me start by saying that I'm going to assume that it's not just market society. Okay? Although I think very often when defenders of capitalism defend capitalism, what they're defending in effect is just a society that has free markets, or at least some form of market exchange. But market exchange can't give us capitalism. I mean, you know, primitive exchange does not give you capitalism. Simple production is not capitalism. We need the productivity of labor to be enhanced by technologies, maybe physical, maybe organizational, probably both. We need, in other words, the deployment of capital in some way to get us to something that we call capitalism. But even then, we're left with a very difficult question, which is, what is capital? And the last time I looked, which was not very hard, but I'm pretty sure that economists haven't come to a common understanding of what capital is. My guess is that they probably never will, because this is in the nature of economic questions. But we're talking about conceptual analysis here, and there are always, you know, questions that can be asked. But I think we can say at least this much, that capital is not a thing. It's not a lump of stuff. It's not a piece of equipment. It's not even necessarily just a system of organization. But it's something that's there because of the social relations we have. So I'm going to make a stab at saying something about what capital is. I'm sure every economist in the room will find fault with the definition, but think of it at least as a heuristic rather than as a definitive statement. I'm going to say that capital and what capital is worth is not fixed, but subject to fluctuations, determined not only by the availability of materials and the technologies that exist, but also by the desires people have and their assessments about the future. What will exist tomorrow, and what will people today want in the future? Indeed, what will future people want? Capital emerges in the process that creates and tries to satisfy desires, but the forms it takes are stable to varying extents, and it exists in a state of flux because we do, within and across generations. What I'm trying to say in a slightly unnecessarily complex way is that the definition of capital is going to vary with time, or at least the things that we identify as capital are going to vary with time, because they're things or relations on the basis of which we will do the kinds of things that we do to enhance the productivity of labor, to create or to destroy, whatever it is that we're pursuing. Capital is not something that we can say easily is to be defined in these ways, and we can set aside and identify them and list them and so on. It's something that's embedded in certain sorts of ways that we relate to one another. This is why we can talk, for example, not only of physical capital, but also about human capital. So this is what I want to say is capitalism. So is capital. Okay. Now, that said, what is capitalism? So one way people have tried to address this question is to talk about the origins of capitalism. But talking about the origins of capitalism immediately, in a way, begs the question, because how far back you go to trace the origins of capitalism will depend on your definition of capitalism. So you'll have to have a prior definition, in which case, you know, searching for the origins is not necessarily going to help you. And the fact that people disagree so much about capitalism is maybe reflected in the fact that they trace its origins back to very, very different times. Alan McFarlane traces it back to the origins of English individualism. Other thinkers have traced it back to the Middle Ages. Some have traced it back to the origins of Islam. I'm not going to try to get into the arguments about this. Karl Marx has his own well-known account of the emergence of capitalism, granting, however, that he doesn't himself use the term capitalism at any point, but the kind of bourgeois society he has in mind. He has his own story about how to define the phenomenon in question. So I'm going to take, at least for the purposes of my argument, Marx's understanding of capitalism as the one that's going to be most useful for my purposes. And what he does is to define capitalism in terms of production for exchange, or let's say profit, rather than for use. Not that this is something that has a very recent history. You can go back as far as you like to see people producing not for immediate consumption, but nonetheless, what Marx has in mind here is the emergence of a system in which the production of commodities for the purposes of exchange, in order to expand the range of commodities available in the pursuit, in other words, of profit, becomes a kind of end in itself. Now, he's not unaware of the fact that, of course, ultimately, as Mises also notes, the point of all production is consumption. But as you push out the end point at which things are consumed further and further out, you have more and more of a system in which the whole purpose, immediately at least, is to create more commodities in order to make profit. In other words, to create commodities for the sake of producing more commodities, as the economist Piero Sraffa put it. What you try to do is you try to make more and better commodities in order to acquire more capital, in order to produce more commodities, in order to ultimately grow your wealth, as that's expressed in terms of commodities or in terms of profit. Now, how do you do this? Well, these are the ways you can accomplish this. Firstly, you can persuade people to buy your commodities, perhaps by superior advertising, by being more persuasive, perhaps by simply producing better commodities, or perhaps by producing commodities that are just as good at a cheaper price. But the other thing you can do is to use what abilities you have, not just to improve what you're trying to present to people or to persuade them to buy from you, but to use that capacity to change the rules by which production is shaped. That is to say, in any system of exchange, what you need are rules which recognize claims, recognize property, recognize what is a legitimate trade, and so on. What you can do is try to change those rules so that they are in your favor. To do this might be regarded as rent seeking, which is exactly what it is, and a large part, significant part, of any kind of system of trade or exchange and so on is, in fact, I would say, rent seeking. Rent seeking is not something peculiar or on the side or a byproduct or an unnecessary intervention in this process. It is at the heart of this process. Everyone who is engaged in activity of this sort is also engaged in rent seeking to the extent that he or she or it is trying to change the rules in his or her favor, or is just trying to defend the status quo, because whatever system operates in a way that distributes rent in some way, there is no natural condition. There is no natural condition because there is no, in my view, no natural right to anything. If they were, we've not been able to find it. Many people have offered theories about this, of course, but there isn't such a thing, in my view. Okay? So what we have, to put it in a slightly different way, is a system in which we're constantly competing in order to enhance the productivity of our own resources, our capital, in order to gain more, whether it's for consumption or the further production of commodities, to enhance what we have, whether it's our wealth or our income, whatever it is, in order to make these gains. And this is the heart and soul of capitalism, which isn't to say that it's also not an integral part of other systems like socialism, only there are further restrictions of what people can do. And if it's ultimately established, maybe it will bring this whole process to a stop. But mostly, I think other social systems that have tried to supplant capitalism have not actually succeeded in eliminating this core aspect of the way that human beings operate and behave and subsist. So here's then a problem for the critics and defenders of capitalism. I think for the defenders of capitalism who want to say that all the things that go wrong with capitalism are the result of unnecessary intervention in the process of capitalism, the problem they have is that all of those interventions are themselves a part of that process. Politics is a part of capitalism. But I think a lot of defenders of capitalism, libertarians in particular, want to suggest that somehow the state, political interventions, interventions by corporations and so on, are somehow interventions in a somehow separate system that has none of these elements in it. But that's just not the case. In fact, I think most interventions, if we can call them that, in the process that we call capitalism come from within, because corporations or firms of one sort or another or private individuals agitate for the modification of the rules or addition of new rules to their own advantage, or perhaps to the advantage of some people they think especially worthy. But that's simply something that goes on within the structure of this process. It's not external. There is no natural order that produces capitalism, which we need to get back to if it weren't for those horrible interventions by rent seekers and so on. That's just not the way it is. But then this also leaves the critics of capitalism with a problem. That is to say, those critics who want not just to reform it in some way, but who want to abolish it. And there are many of them who want to abolish capitalism and replace it. And I'll talk about these shortly. The problem is, where is the source of this change? Where's this change going to come from? Because the assumption is that somehow we're going to be able to take control of this whole and replace it with something else. Most of the rhetoric about, you know, ending capitalism is rhetoric of this sort. And it's simply, I think, implausible because it's making an assumption about how we can deal with a system in such a way as to actually transform it and even abolish it while we are right inside of it with no experience of anything else. So with that, let me give you then my definition of capitalism before turning in more detail to the critics. So I'm going to say that capitalism is to be defined as follows: the system of rules and norms and values that amounts to the process that creates capital and allows those who possess capital to try and increase the value of their capital by intervening in the structure, whether by investing in the production of commodities or acting to change parts of the structure itself, is capitalism. It's the system of rules that produces capital, and it includes aspects of that process which involves trying to actually change the parts of the structure itself. That's what capitalism is. It's not just some independent structure. It's a structure that operates in a way that includes people constantly trying to change that very structure. So there are numerous criticisms of capitalism that have been made by people who want to abolish it. I'm going to focus on two general kinds of critics. The first one, some of you may recognize, is Professor Jerry Cohen. Died a few years ago. He was professor of political theory at Oxford, Marxist by ideology and analytical philosopher by training. And he has two kinds of criticisms of capitalism. One is that it makes people unfree, and the second is that capitalism is unjust. So he shares this with Karl Marx, who also thought that under capitalism, everyone was unfree, dominated by an alien power. So What are the criticisms that Cohen himself advances? The unfreedom arguments that he have, I think, aren't always, I think, terribly convincing, because some of them are quite poor. For example, he tries to argue that under capitalism, the workers are unfree because they can't all escape the working class, even though some of them can escape the working class. I'm not sure why everybody being able to get out of the working class is a necessary condition of their being able to escape it. It's a bit like saying the problem is that not everyone can get out of being in the bottom 10%. I'm not sure why that is a particularly convincing kind of argument, but he has other arguments which are closer to the arguments that Karl Marx wanted to offer, which is to say that in some way everyone is unfree because they're ultimately all dominated by a kind of alien power. That is to say, they're dominated by a structure that leaves them at the mercy of forces that they cannot control. And this goes back to this point I made at the beginning, that you know, at the heart of this worry about capitalism is the feeling that we're not somehow in control of something that we should be in control of. But in this regard, I think Cohen's arguments are not especially novel. So I'm just going to skip those for the moment and come back to other versions of it, but turn to a different kind of argument that he wants to make, which is that the problem with capitalism is that it's unjust. Okay, why is it unjust? Well, it's unjust, he says, because workers are rewarded unequally. The talented have to be bribed in order to be more productive. And we owe the wealth that capitalism creates to the activities of these very, very productive people. But they're only productive, he says, because we reward them for being so productive. But surely, he says, in a just society, everyone would be paid the same. Okay? If you're lucky enough to be talented, well, you should just work for the common good and not be rewarded so inequitably. Now, I think this is a strange kind of argument in a way, because while he thinks that what capitalism rests on is a kind of pandering to the people who are lucky enough to be born talented, I'm not sure he recognizes the extent to which probably the most talented and richest would probably just keep working anyway. The problem is that if we were all simply rewarded equally, I'm not sure that I would grade as many essays as I do. It's not those jobs that, or rather, it's not the rewarding parts of being a scholar that I have to be rewarded for. It's the other things, right? I could imagine that, in a world in which everyone was simply paid the same, but you were all encouraged to or required to work, many people would do things like, set up society companies for the production of poetry and then sell, this poetry. And if they don't make any money, it doesn't matter because everyone's going to be rewarded equally. No one's going to sweep the roads. No one's going to clean the bathrooms. We'll all become poets. And that seems like an implausible form of social organization. In the end, Cohen doesn't really tell us a lot about how it is that a socialist society, which is his alternative to capitalism, will be organized. But he gives us a kind of idea in his little book, Why Not Socialism, in which he says, well, look, let's try to imagine, a camping trip. Some of you may have read this book. And he says, couldn't we have society organized like a camping trip where we all, pitch in, we all share our food, we all work cooperatively to make sure that, the campsite's clean and looked after, that nature is, taken care of. But it's simply a metaphor. It doesn't actually say anything practical about how a socialist, non-capitalist society would be organized. All he's trying to say is, look, we should have a society that's run on the basis of not greed, generosity. But in the end, it ends up just being a kind of lamentation. And I think, in a way, kind of lamentation about the human condition. It's a shame that we aren't all a bit more generous in the way that we organize ourselves. But he's, in the end, saying, well, you know, I don't know how this is going to change, but maybe one day someone will invent something, a technology that's superior to capitalism, because it draws on our generosity rather than our greed. But as I said, I think this is nothing more than a lamentation. So let me turn to a very different kind of theorist, Nancy Fraser, who's a political philosopher at the City University of New York, vigorously anti-capitalism, a bit more angrily anti-capitalism. And here's what she has to say about the problem with capitalism. Okay, so it's marked by crises. It's marked by rampaging inequality and precarious low-wage work, discrimination against migrants, racialized violence. It's an ecological disaster. So capitalism is to blame for, you know, the excess of production that's damaging the planet. And it's to blame for militarism, strongman rule, structural injustice, class exploitation, gender domination. I think you can imagine all of this in greater detail, so I won't belabor it. But her question is, how are we to dismantle capitalism? Okay, how are we to replace it? So here are her solutions. So firstly, she says, capitalist societies subordinate the imperatives of social, political, and ecological reproduction to those of commodity production, which is itself just geared to accumulation. That's what capitalism is about. It's just about accumulation. So what we've got to do is turn all this around, okay? To install the nurturing of people, the safeguarding of nature, democratic rule, self-rule as society's highest priorities. Much more important than efficiency and growth. And this means, she thinks, what we have to do is democratize the process of institutional change. And what this requires? Well, it requires a metapolitical process to redomain, she puts it, political spaces democratically. So how is this going to work, according to Nancy Fraser? Well, what you'll have, she says, is this new social democracy with collective control of something she calls the social surplus. Presumably, capitalist societies generate all this surplus, which now needs to be allocated. As it stands, it just goes to the wealthy, but we can reallocate this. But we should include in the process of allocation all those who are affected by this, which means pretty much everything, so that we can limit growth for the health of the planet and only retain markets as they need it. So no markets at the top, so no financial markets, I presume, and no markets at the bottom, because all of people's basic needs have to be met. But maybe markets in the middle. But markets will play no role in the allocation of the social surplus or providing for basic needs. Bottom and top are socialized and decommodified, and we have markets in between. Now, I think all of you in this room will have views about these solutions, and some of them are obviously quite familiar, but they're not the ones that I want to draw attention to. The obvious ones, I think, include the argument that socialism simply cannot work because of the calculation problem. Mises, Hayek, the story is probably familiar to everyone here. And it's not the kind of road to serfdom argument that Hayek makes, which is the argument that attempts to control this process in some ways will simply generate the demand for greater and greater control over people. Because if you try to control one aspect, then you're going to have to control another aspect in order to assert control over the whole. And what this will ratchet up is the creation of a structure which is limiting of human freedom. But I want to draw attention to something else that's implicit in what these critics of capitalism are saying. I think what's implicit in it is an assumption that we're somehow all the same, that we're all alike. And I want to say that this is a mistake. Even though it might seem obvious, I think I want to say a little bit more about why they've not recognized this. And that we're not only different, but we're also, in a way, becoming more and more different. Thomas Friedman says the world is flat, and to some extent that's true, but it's also true that we all sing different tunes and we sing in different keys, and this is becoming more and more significant. So let me elaborate on this by turning back to human nature. I want to say that we're different in three ways. Okay, we're different culturally, we're different in terms of character, and we're different to the extent that we've become serial hyper-specializers. And let me elaborate on each of these three things. Let me start with human nature and our nature as culturally distinctive beings. It's in our nature to be culturally different. We are culturally different, obviously, in different parts of the world. We'll see it more evidently, but even within our own societies, we can see distinctive cultural elements. But my point is that this is something that's built into our nature. We're, by our nature, inclined to form cultural groupings. This means we're, by nature, inclined to have different ends or purposes. We're going to have different views about what is valuable. We're going to have different views about what is right. And ultimately, we're going to have different views about politics and about what constitutes a legitimate form of authority or indeed a legitimate form of rules. We're different, not just individually, but we're different in groups. And of course, some people move easily between different groups, between different cultures, but not everyone does. And I see this tendency to differentiation, not just individually, but in terms of groups, as something that is ineradicable about our nature or in our nature. The other way in which we differ, and I think critics of capitalism haven't recognized this, is that we have different characters. In part, this is simply the fact that we have different psychological traits. We have different personalities and strengths, different weaknesses, virtues. We have different vices. There are people you just don't want to go on a camping trip. There are people, if you were on a camping trip, will not survive your wrath. Yeah, that's just the nature of things. Anyone who thinks differently has probably never been on a camping trip, except maybe solo. So the fact that we are possessed of different character traits, I think, is significant. And maybe even more so once you recognize that, you know, 30% of the population globally is supposed to have a certain level of psychopathy. And some studies suggest that 1% of American men are clinically psychopathological, and most of them tend to cluster in either prisons or very, very high public office, whether that's corporations or politics. That's just built into our DNA. I don't think we're going to be able to get rid of it, even with selective breeding, because, well, who's going to control the breeding except the psychopaths, right? So positions of power will always be held mainly by people who will do what it takes to get it and will do what it takes to keep it. Okay. So I think this is something that's important. But there's another aspect of our nature which is worth noting, and this is our nature as hyper-specializers. I take this term from the American philosopher Elijah Milgram, who says in his book, The Great Endarkenment, that we are serial hyper-specializers. And this is the result of centuries of the division of labor and the division of knowledge. Over the centuries, the millennia, the human world has become more and more complex, but equally less and less intelligible. In a way, he's making even more of a point that Hayek makes when he says that, you know, civilization progresses, we in a way come to know less and less about the way the whole thing operates, but we need to know less and less. Okay? That's in fact a kind of way in which we mark ourselves as living in a civilized community, because we need to know so little in order to access so much. But Milgram's point is slightly different from Hayek's. Well, what he wants to say is that as the world has become more complex and less intelligible, it's also become a world which is less communicable across specialisms. I mean, think about how difficult it is to talk across disciplines within academia, or even within disciplines. Can philosophers talk to other philosophers if they're in the same discipline but different subfields or different subfields? I mean, I think very often the answer is no, because they just cannot master the literature. They may understand it in a certain minimal way, but they'll be behind those who are really specializing in a particular topic. Now, this means that the world is now full of public spaces inhabited by specialists who cannot understand other specialized public spaces. They can talk to one another, but they can't talk to other parts of the world, except to the extent that they can rely on user interfaces in order to communicate. But they're not communicating at the substratum level, if you like. In a way, it's by, like, you know, operating as I do my Apple laptop, and I see these icons and I click on them and I can move them. I have no idea what's going on underneath. For all I know, there are just mice in the machine doing stuff. And when I click on them, I'm sending them a signal to do certain things. Someone has coded everything so that it does the things that I wanted to do. But there's a certain sense in which I have no idea at all about the processes. And I don't mean at the level of quantum mechanics. I mean just at the very, very basic, simple level of computer science. But of course, computer scientists themselves will have specialisms and subspecialisms and subspecialisms. Now, why does any of this matter? Because in some ways it seems kind of obvious. Again, at least once I've pointed out to you, I don't think that many of you are going to disagree with this observation. And I think it matters because if we're looking to transform society or create a new society, we need to understand what we're working with. And the critics of capitalism are thinking we need to transform this. As the Indian writer Arundhati Roy writes in Criticism of Capitalism, we need to put a cap on it. We need to put a lid on this thing. But how? I mean, how is it that we're going to control this thing, which is so not just complex, but is so unlike, say, a Death Star, where you've just got to find that one thing that's there and you fire the missile at it and the whole thing blows up. Happens to all the Death Stars, I'm told, and it's obviously a design flaw. Capitalism doesn't have that. There isn't that point. There isn't that, you know, because it's this vast thing that's undesigned, uncreated, that's evolved in a way that reflects our nature, but cannot be controlled or destroyed by a single bullet or even a whole team led by Luke Skywalker and his friends. It's just not possible. But the assumptions made all the time are that it's possible to do something. What we have is this world of hyper-specializers in different cultures, interlinked in a world that's both porous and networked. and in different kinds of entities, from firms, different sizes, to villages, to provinces, to superstates, to corporations. And they're all linked by this vast network of trade, exchanges, and so on, which is difficult to shape, to transform, to take control of. So when people are talking about transforming capitalism, taking control of it, what is it that they've got in mind? Well, here's what I want to suggest they have to have in mind, and that is that they've got to transform the whole world. You can't talk about just, say, transforming capitalism by transforming it in a city, because people will move. Well, you could try to do it at the level of a country or the state, but that's not possible either, because people will move. You want to do it at the level of the superstate? I still don't think that's plausible. Are you going to control the whole of the EU without any kind of flight by people? I don't think so. But if you're going to try to transform it at the level of the globe, then that seems, on the one hand, to make sense, because you're trying to control the whole of the system. But it seems to me like this is the idea that's the least feasible. But this is what the critics of capitalism are aiming for, to control the whole thing. So how? Well, there are two strategies, I think, that are recommended, or at least obvious. One is the strategy that Nancy Fraser recommends, which is democracy. Everyone in the city-state, or the superstate, or the world, depending on where you're aiming, would have to agree to replace capitalism. We can do this democratically. This calls to mind my favorite American expression, which is, good luck with that. It's just hard to imagine that this is even remotely feasible. But I mention it because this is implicit in the whole idea that we're going to put a lid on capitalism, put a cap on it, or, you know, transform it, that we're somehow going to take control of this whole thing democratically. Everyone's going to agree democratically. Okay, well, what's the other alternative? Well, I'm going to call this the Leninist strategy. Still requires a certain amount of agreement, though. I mean, someone's going to take control of the commanding heights and enforce a new kind of order. But again, firstly, I don't see the Leninists all agreeing. I don't see China agreeing to turn around and say, yeah, okay, we're all going to get together and we'll come to an agreement on what we need to do to transform capitalism. I don't think even the Sultan of Brunei could be persuaded, no matter what. Who's going to give up power? The Leninists have this same sort of problem. That is to say, you're going to have to come to some sort of agreement. There is no Darth Vader who's going to be able to rule the universe. It's simply not a plausible idea. So this brings me to another thought then that the critics of capitalism which is to say, but surely there's got to be a better way. Even if this critique is fine so far, we've got to find a solution. Maybe Marx's theory of alienation tells you something about why they think this way. The world in which we live is one in which we fail to realize our real nature. Marx calls this our species being. Albert Camus once remarked that man is the only creature that refuses to be what he is. This is what Marx wants, and this is what the critics of capitalism want. They want us to be what we really could be. But maybe this is what we are. We're beings who are not meant to be anything in particular. Our nature is not to conform to any particular nature. And if that's the case, then we're caught in a paradox. But I would say, well, then that's just it. We're paradoxical. Okay? We want to control ourselves, but we can't, because that's in our very nature. we want to fix the world as if we stood there from the outside, you know, like looking down at Adam Smith's famous chessboard. But in this case, it's not just that the pieces have ways of moving that are beyond our control, but we ourselves are the pieces. We're trying to imagine that somehow we're looking down on this chessboard, but we're not. We're sitting there in the middle of it, thinking that we're going to do things differently. So this is what we are. We're stuck on this hurtling rock, but we're somehow constantly imagining that we're going to step outside of it and fix it, and fix it to our own liking, as if we'll either get everyone to agree to the same thing, or we'll eventually transform them to appreciate the way we should be, the way we should really be. And the story is so utterly implausible, it's hard to understand why anyone has actually bought into it. But they still are. All these people I'm citing were not writing in the 17th century. They were writing in the 21st with everything that we know. So I think in that sense, the point just bears repeating. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.